This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is a poem by the Buddhist nun, monastic, Jingang. This floating life, an ever-changing dream, yet we bitterly toil away. The entire day full of busyness as our karma grinds us down. If only you can make a clean sweep of the cave of ignorance, you'll be left with a life full of leisurely freedom and ease. Human life in this mirage of a world are kept going by desire. Once desire stops, all is the realm of the great enlightened one. The masters of the heavens and hells will find themselves speechless. Having poked through the web, there'll be no conditions of desire. The mind, always composed and calm, that is the original purity. Careful study and accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions. If you immediately change your life and step onto the further shore, your ignorance will shatter on its own with a laugh and song. Understand the ordinary mind and realize one is naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your mother and father were born. When you've seen through the method that underlies them all, the mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. Jingang was a Chinese monastic. She lived in the first half of the 1600s. And she had a strong desire to live a religious life, to be ordained and devote her life to the Dharma since an early age. But she had family and social expectations and obligations. And so, although she would have preferred not to marry, she went along with what her parents wanted and expected of her. So she did marry, and her husband died an early death. We'll just leave it at that. She took care of her parents and her husband's parents as well, and until they passed away, and then she was able to fulfill her dream, her aspiration. And even after she became the abbess of a thriving monastic community, she would visit her students that were ill. She would bring them food and medicinal broths, which is said she would feed with her own hands. One of her disciples, Yikui, says that she was very frugal in terms of her own needs, that she wore a very simple, bare, sort of very thin, coarse robe, no matter what the weather. But she would be much more giving, abundant with others. One very cold winter, she and one of her disciples visited a community of monks who were really suffering because of the cold. And so when they went back to the convent, she had all of her disciples sew leggings for them so they would be warm. And her biographer, the scholar who collected this, put together this collection of poems, said that ultimately what is most significant is that expressions of what might be called traditional feminine roles, those of her being very caring and compassionate, coexisted with other traits that were might be considered more masculine, such as engaging in very rigorous ascetic practices and very demanding Dharma study, building and guiding monasteries and offering public teachings, taking on students, having successors. And Beata Grant, who was the author, the scholar who put this together, said that although Xingang and her disciples were by no means completely transcendent of traditional expectations of female behavior of that time, their membership or their lives within the Linji lineages, because they were in the Rinzai or Linji lineage, with its traditional emphasis on the unmediated realization of Buddha nature beyond all duality, including that of gender, allowed them a freedom and a flexibility that they would have never found through loyalty to the Confucian patriarchal line. And so she had this very strong aspiration, and she also had obligations. You know, in our culture, we tend to our culture, this country is made of many, many different cultures. But within certain cultures, there's little bowing to familial obligations, which is perhaps the anomaly in history and in the world. And so she had to wait. She did fulfill those obligations until she was free to pursue the Dharma full time. And in all that time, her dedication, her yearning, her fire remained very hot. And it said that as did other masters at that time, and really going back to the Buddha, she had to demonstrate and defend her accomplishment, her wisdom, through different kinds of debates. Dharma encounter really has its roots in that kind of Dharma debate that really did begin there. I mean, many sutras of the Buddha in which he is being challenged, sometimes very respectfully and sometimes less so, by practitioners of other spiritual communities and other teachers. And says that Xingang's biographers make mention of the many men of letters, the scholars of Confucianism, of various traditions, of the brush, of calligraphy, and just worldly people, as well as Buddhist monks, who came to engage her in debate. Being well known, having established herself as a powerful teacher, then people wanted to challenge her, and says that ultimately they found themselves stuttering and feeling foolish. So I'd like to today just take up the first part of this poem, and then on Saturday we'll do the last part, talk a little bit more about her. So this poem is New Admonitions to the Assembly. This floating life, an ever-changing dream, and yet we bitterly toil away, like a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning, like the morning dew, like the rain that comes and goes. All things everywhere are passing before our eyes in every moment, ever-changing, never the same. This is the dream. When it comes, when we're asleep, it gets our attention. We dive into it and go wherever it goes. And it's so real. And in waking life, it's so much like that too. We enter into it, take it as real unto itself, something that is happening that has its own story, and we jump into it to add our story to it. And if we're ambitious, try to make something to leave behind, a monument, a marker, child. And then one day we wake up. Too often when we're dead, we wake up and wonder, what was that that went by so fast? By then it's too late. It's done. Only yesterday the Sangha began. Just a blink of an eye. And now we're in its final days. Barely an instant ago, the session began. And barely an instant from now, it'll be done. Over. Never to come again. When we started the Ango, we had, probably each of us had plans, intentions, some sense of how these 3 months were going to go. Where are those now? All of our certainties, where are they? They basically just get wasted through the course of our lives, one by one, sometimes in bundles. Where are they actually fixed? Are they fixed anywhere? And why do we feel so compelled to make them? It's hard not to think that they're really the, all of our clinging is just sort of the desperate acts of desperation to buffer us against the ultimate fear that in fact nothing is fixed. And that somehow that's a problem. That if we could just solve that problem, make things last, obtain something and hold on to it, become immortal. I mean, talk about curses. Think about it if you live forever. I don't know. I think that could be a very short-lived party. You know, we might underestimate the importance of power of having a great aspiration without expectations. What that avails to us, which is basically everything. To bring forth confidence, cultivate clarity that's not based in presumption, assumptions, false certainties, false views, nothing to, as an old wise person said, nothing to live and die for. Yet, as Jingang says, we, so many of us, and for the most part, bitterly toil away. The weight of our dreams, dreamt, broken, dreamt again, broken again. It's heavy. It's a heavy load to carry. So many things build up, so many resentments, so many disappointments, so many things that should have happened and didn't, so many people that should have been there and weren't. And because we're the sort of sole survivor of that particular drama, it can seem sometimes as though we're the only one. And so we can toil away and become embittered. I mean, think of all the, Kosho talked about righteousness, think of all the righteousness that we see in the world. People believing that they deserve things. Right? And, I mean, in a sense we do. If we were a caring, compassionate, wise society, we would try and make sure that everybody had enough. Everybody had what was needed. But these unreal expectations, because I'm white, because I'm male, because I'm this, I'm that, deserve something even though others don't. But what is this toiling away within, alongside sacred activity? We recognize that our everyday actions, our simple everyday actions, are wonderful, wondrous in their simplicity. How does that line up with bitterly toiling away? Same actions, same things need to be done. What makes the difference? We should want to know. And so, as Sesshin, we dream ourselves awake, dream ourselves into an exquisite dream that is exquisite because now we know it's a dream. Knowing it's a dream, it's fine. It's fine to dream. Everybody's dreaming. What else is there? But now we can dream ourselves awake again and again. It's not the same dream. It's made of the same stuff, but it's not the same dream. Xingang lived a real life. She was a real person, which seems like a sort of strange thing to say, who is not a real person. But when we talk about somebody, to some degree, they become less real. Over time and distance, they become more unreal, less real. If they're well known, then they become wildly unreal. Her life wasn't all easy by a long shot. She lived very simply. She lived rigorously. She was dedicated to the Dharma. She took her responsibilities seriously. She took care of her practice, and she tended to the needs of others. She's a basic bodhisattva. She was joyful, as testified to by some of her closest disciples. Since how else could she have inspired so many if she wasn't an example herself? How does such spare living bring forth joy? Right? Because that just seems all wrong according to our sort of formula for the good life, which is don't be spare about anything. Pile it on, and then pile it on some more. But how much joy do we see that bringing? To live a simple life has been recognized by practitioners and seekers throughout history as having something essential. And we see these similarities in different traditions, different practitioners. You know, they're on to something. They're seeing something about what it means to be a human being and be devoted to actually living this life. When we live simply, it brings us closer. Things become more brought down to the elements. That's what Sesshin does, right? Things are just brought down to the basic things. Sitting, walking, pooping, eating, a little bit of work. It's similar to what happens in some intentional situations, like when people go camping or they go out into the elements, they get elemental. Right? If they don't, they tend to get very, very uncomfortable, like people you see hiking with huge, huge packs, right? Trying to bring everything from home. But also in times of stress, in times of disaster, even in times of war, when all of the sort of ornaments are gone. There's no time. They're not important. What's important is living, helping others live, staying alive, and being alive. You know, people who have been in close to death, sometimes in, you know, moments of great falling apart, and people who have studied this often talk about how in those moments, the world that they're in becomes, slows down and becomes vibrantly alive. That even as they are moving into impending disaster, that they notice things like the color of the sky. They see an insect. Kind of interesting. The entire day full of busyness as our karma grinds us down. Well, you could say we live a busy life. We go from one thing to the next. But it's all about not being busy within the wondrous simplicity of our actions. Not being busy. Not toiling. Not being bitter. Our karma grinds us down. Our samskaras, the karmic formations, all the things that we accumulate over our lives, all of these experiences, all of those disappointments, all of those things that didn't work out, or the things that did, and then betrayed us by leaving, departing, changing, the ever-changing dream. All that arises from our consciousness forms into desires, our intentions, our actions. And as we live, they build deep furrows in the ground. And we get stuck in those furrows. Our perceptions, our views, our preferences, predilections becomes kind of more and more a little bit robotic. You know, our responses are, you know, we sort of fight tenaciously, hold on tenaciously to the sense that we're free and we love our freedom and we are making our own choices, and it's not quite so simple. But within not being, having utterly free will, which isn't even a question in Buddhism, doesn't even come up. It's kind of interesting. It's not really the question that's being asked. And when a question isn't being asked, it's because what's important isn't understood, or it's understood as not being important. And so when we think of the teachings of the Dharma and all of the Dharma traditions, of Buddha Dharma, the things that are being talked about, the things that are being taught are the things that are important, have been proven to be important by those who have wanted to know. And seeing this ongoing involvement in our own mind, in our body, with ourselves, our thoughts, our self, and seeing more and more just the moment-to-moment creation arising, building, and then passing. Arising again, building, and then it passes. Even those things that we're sure are going to last forever, they disappear too. So what happens when all of that stops, ceases? When that candle that's burning is blown out, what happens then? Because we see that the only thing there The only person there is, the only world, the only life there is within all of those building projects, which has to be a big part of why we're reluctant to let them go. Because then what? You know, that's why when we imagine emptiness, we imagine it as some terrible, scalding desert or some terrible, freezing cold space, right? When we think of emptiness, nothingness, shunyata, voidness, right? So we gather back in all of our projects, right? And even though some of them are crumbling down and they're actually falling on us and they're on fire, it gives us something to do, right? We have employment. We're busy. But that's the dream, right? That increasingly over time becomes a bit of a nightmare. Which when we recognize that, something is changing. A possibility is being born. So Xingang says, if only you can make a clean sweep of the cave of ignorance, you'll be left with a life full of leisurely freedom and at ease. You know, when teachers say such things, and it's like, oh, okay, I'll just make a clean sweep. I'm good with that. How about now? And then we realize, wait a minute, it's not so easy. And then we might get angry and say, why do you say such a thing? And in the moment when that clean sweep occurs, we realize, oh, she was telling the truth. It's just a clean sweep. Clean sweep in one complete moment, swept clean. Just don't bring it back into being. Just don't start dreaming again. And yet, Master Kazon said, everyone wants a pure, clear, spotless mind, but try as you will, you cannot sweep away all the dust. So who's right? They're saying, speaking the same with the same tongue, from the same place. Not a single thing has ever been swept away. Realizing that, swept away. The great way is not difficult, just don't pick and choose. When you do, sweep that clean and realize not a single thing is changing. And yet, it must be swept clean. How do we face the bitter toil, the weight of our pain and distress without hating it? Or more to the point, perhaps, without hating ourselves? How do we accept this freedom and ease that is your birthright, that is a natural arising from practice without loving it? Trungpa Rinpoche spoke about this. He said, in the beginning, when we first meet our teacher, which can also be the Dharma, and we're trying to receive the teachings, it's necessary to surrender our ego, to surrender our expectations. If we don't do this completely, the teacher or the Dharma will create a shock. The world does that too. A situation will be created to shake us, to help us give up and let go of all of our preconceived ideas. And that really means every single one. All of them. Even the good ones. Even the great ones. Especially the great ones. He said, to do this, faith is very important. That's why in relating with a teacher, the Dharma, and learning these teachings. We need to go through some hardship. And this is one of the things that's, I think, increasingly difficult to understand, because hardship, although it has not gone away by any means, and for some people is, for many people, is a principle of life. In so many more advantaged lives, hardship is becoming, it seems, a thing of the past, something we've sort of figured out and resolved. And this is actually a problem. And it's a problem in Dharma practice. Trungpa says, you need to use your own intelligence in order to learn or to actually receive something from the teacher. You could purely put yourself under the mercy of a teacher and expect that the teacher will give you a kind of university course in which you don't really have to think. You just do your readings and attend tutorials and write things down, and as everything has already been thought out for you. But that's very unhealthy. It doesn't develop faith and confidence. True confidence must be a very manual confidence. We can't automate it. It's something we actually have to do. This manual approach doesn't just belong to the East. I'm sure that such an approach took place in medieval times in the West as well. Faith is very connected with confidence. And what's important here, what he says, is the type of faith we're talking about here, in order to have this, you also need a great deal of independence. You do not feel that you're being saved by joining some organization or by following a particular pattern. You don't need reassurance from other people or situations. You need a certain amount of faith in yourself, and you need the faith and confidence of being willing to face, as far as you can today, the crude and rugged quality of your ego, of yourself. And you need the determination to go through the treatment. You need to be willing to face the kill or cure. Without confidence in yourself, faith will be purely a substitution for a kind of parental security. It'll mean that you're trying to be dependent on something else rather than actually being willing to open yourself. So you need a great deal of independence. He says, at the beginning, our whole way of being isn't all that genteel. Everything is quite hard in the living of life. He says, you don't have things like central air heating or central air conditioning. It's hot. It's toilsome. It's kind of disagreeable in a whole bunch of ways. And he says, this is where we learn. We learn from this struggle. And the thing is, we don't have to do much for that to happen. You know, we don't go out and scale mountains or, you know, fast in the desert for 7 days or, you know, do all kinds of, you know, painful ascetic practices. We don't have to do much. We just get up before the sunrise, sit on a cushion, live together, take responsibility. And step by step, in little things, little actions, little responsibilities that develop into larger responsibilities, little by little, we develop that quality of learning to be independent. Through these small earthbound details, he says, you begin to see your connection to the earth and its solidity, the solidness of it, the earthiness of it. It makes you think. Training makes you think. It makes you work for yourself. If everything has already been taught to you, printed and published and illustrated, then you don't have to do anything. This is not healthy. And so when the scholar speaks about Xingang's having these two qualities, these masculine and feminine qualities, which perhaps one day we'll just be able to recognize as human qualities, as they are. It's these different aspects. You know, this independence, which is not isolation, it's not, this sort of the American idea of independence. It's just standing on our own two feet. It's touching the earthiness, the solidity, the solidness of the ground. It's actually doing, learning on our own, figuring things out as we go, encountering all kinds of problems, expectations that don't work out, things that other people do that aren't always so great. And the tendency to think is that if we just sort of get rid of all of those things, create conditions where those things don't happen, then there won't be any more hardships. But the hardship then is the box we put ourselves in. And of course, this is all to be understood within a real practice. Right? So it doesn't just mean anything goes. It doesn't just mean act out when you want to. That'll be good for other people. That's not what it means. Doesn't mean if I say something, you've got a problem with it, that's your problem. That's not what it means. That's cut off. That's not being independent, not the way he's speaking about. Because the other side of that is that we are dependent upon each other. That isolated, I can't do much at all, except sing a song about myself to myself. Which, there's a whole lot of that going on. Isolated, there's very little I can actually do. Being dependent upon you, there's not much I can't do. And the unity, the coming together, the merging, the stepping in and out of this dependence and independence is training. That's why a sufficient amount of instruction is given, but not too much. A sufficient amount of guidance is given, and not too much. And of course, that's different for different people. It's not the same for everybody. That when we stumble, a sufficient amount of support should show up, but not too much. Stumbling is how we learn to stand. Stumbling is how we learn to stumble. Jingang says, human life in this mirage of a world it kept going by desire. Once desire stops, then all is the realm of the great enlightened one. The masters of heavens and hells will find themselves speechless. Having poked through the web, there will be no conditions of desire. I vowed to put an end to my endless desires. That's a real vow. We're not playing with that. We're not playing with words. It's not wordplay. It means exactly what it says. I vowed to put an end to my endless desires. It is deliberately not made easy to understand, because it is not easy to realize it. It is not even easy to practice it. And so to make it easy to understand would rob us, would give us a false impression of something. Once desire stops, all is the realm of the great enlightened one. And that is not either what we think it is, because desires are endless. And so when you have dreamt yourself into hell, tread lightly. Don't add more fire to the fire. But don't take it lightly either, because it's hell. And when you've dreamt yourself into heaven, tread lightly. Don't fall in love. Don't get infatuated. It's only heaven. When you want what you don't have, when you have what you don't want, when that person you so count on has walked away, when the person you have trouble with won't leave your side, what do we do with that dream? Practicing the ever-changing dreams is the path. Within that dream, how do you dream yourself awake? You have to use what Rinpoche is calling your intelligence, which is, there's intelligence involved. That's why right understanding is where it starts. You basically use everything. You know, that's what happens when we're in situations that bring us down to the elements, is you learn how to, you know, make a fire with stones and sticks. You learn how to get water from unlikely places. And to learn those skills, and they are skills, we need help. But we also need a somewhat desperate situation. Right, it's hard to do that. It's hard to work that hard when you don't have to. It's hard to put the effort into realizing the deathless when you're going to live forever. Why bother? The masters of the heavens and hells will find themselves speechless. Having poked through the web, there will be no more conditions of desire. It's the same world. We're in the same place with the same people. How is it that those conditions have so changed? Where have they changed? Where has the change occurred? Where does change ever occur? And so isn't that it? That's the point, is that in the moment when we are stuck, being truly stuck, if you are truly stuck, then you have defied all of the forces of the universe. Congratulations. And I'm sorry. So when you are convinced that you are absolutely stuck, can't be. It isn't. And so that means in that moment, figure it out. Right? Not just throwing a deck of cards up in the air and hoping you land with an ace, but actually applying the Dharma. Applying the Dharma to yourself. To enter into the realm of the great enlightened one, which is a family of sane and noble beings who are human. They're human. I remember years ago talking to a young person who was here, and they were going on and on about a teacher, a well-known teacher, and how incredibly compassionate and gentle and loving and on and on and on. And I said, have you ever met this person? They said, yes, I received the teachings. I said, but have you met them? This person that you're describing, where are they? In another poem, Xingang said, understand your ordinary mind and realize you are naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your mother and father were born. When you have seen through the method that underlies them all, the mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. This is the last verse. Realize your ordinary mind and realize you're naturally complete. Have faith that you are naturally complete and practice your ordinary mind. You don't have to wait. Ask urgently who you are before your mother and father were born. Before they created you. But why go that far back? How about right now, before you created you? Who are you? The mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. When all that separates us drops away, and our heart opens, and we realize the heart of the world is open. When we turn to look at the world itself is looking back. As Jada Roshi said, when you nod, you can only nod to yourself.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.